Good news about the impact of mandatory health insurance.
How much of autism is due to genetic determinants?
Diabetes on the way up, both types, unfortunately.
And does immunizing pregnant women protect their infants against whooping cough?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on May 9th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, we're back recording remotely again, but welcome back to the U.S.
I'd say the same to you.
I appreciate being back. Let's turn then to something that we've incepted here in the U.S. and that I think is really good news in Annals of Internal Medicine this week, the impact of health insurance, mandatory health insurance on that population who lives in Massachusetts.
Okay, so just to catch everybody up to date, Massachusetts passed comprehensive health care reform in 2006, and their goal was the same as the Affordable Care Act, near universal coverage. What Massachusetts did in their law was they expanded Medicaid, they offered subsidized private insurance, and they created an individual mandate. In essence, it was the model for the Affordable Care Act. Previous research has documented that the Massachusetts reform succeeded in doing several things. It expanded health care insurance, particularly among adults aged 19 to 64. It improved access to care, as did use of preventive services and functional status. But the real question is, does it actually change mortality? And that was what this study did. It examined mortality rates before and after reform in Massachusetts and compared it to a control group that had a very similar population. However, there was no health care reform. As a result of the reforms in Massachusetts, it was associated with a significant decrease in all-cause mortality compared with the control group. It decreased by almost 3%. And more importantly, when they examined just deaths caused from things that were amenable to changes in the health care, it decreased mortality by about 4.5%. These changes were larger in counties that had lower household incomes and higher uninsured rates. This is, as you said, good news. Now, it doesn't associate causality, but it's a very tight association.
I actually thought it was really pretty good, not to mention the fact that the numbers were gigantic.
There were a huge number of patients. They showed data 5 years beforehand and showed that there's no difference in the mortality trends. Also, there was no difference in mortality among the elderly, and that's because the elderly already had insurance because of Medicare.
And bolsters the argument, of course, that we should all have universal health insurance. That would be one thing. And I would also point out that the people who are benefiting from this are people in those productive times of their lives. So saving those lives benefits everybody.
Yeah, in fact, they did an analysis, what's called a number needed to treat. You needed to provide additional health care to 830 adults to prevent one death per year.
I like that one. So now let's stick with Annals of Internal Medicine and take a look at kind of the other end of life. And that's the administration of Tdap, the vaccine, tetanus, diphtheria, and acellular pertussis during pregnancy. Does it protect the offspring?
And the reason why we're addressing this is because whooping cough or pertussis is highly contagious and it's potentially fatal, but it's preventable with vaccines. The whole issue of whooping cough has reemerged in the United States, particularly over the last several years, with the highest incidence being last couple years. There have been 40 to 50,000 cases. Individuals that are at highest risk are infants that are younger than 6 months of age. They account for 90% of all whooping cough associated deaths in the United States. Those kids are too young to actually receive immunization. So how do you protect them? So in 2011, the recommendation was that unimmunized women who had never received Tdap receive it. Then finally in 2012, the recommendation was we ought to give it to all pregnant women, even if they have received immunizations, because the immunization wanes. But there have been some concerns about that. One is it safe? Two is it effective? For mothers that have already received vaccination, does it boost their antibody count? Is that passed across the placenta? And then just as important, when the child is immunized between the ages of 2 months and a year, does the mother's immunization somehow prevent the baby's immunization from being effective? So this was a study done in a small number of women, 45 women who were pregnant, age 18 to 45 years. Two-thirds of them received the vaccination and a third did not. And this was during the last trimester of pregnancy. Here's what they determined. determine there was not an increased risk of adverse events either among the women who received the vaccine or among their infants. The maternal immunization resulted in very high concentrations of the antibodies in the mother and in the infants during the first 2 months of life, and it did not adversely affect the infant's response to their own vaccination months later. The caveat is it's in a small number of women. The study was actually initiated before the more recent recommendations in 2012 came out to give the vaccine to pregnant women.
Clearly, what would close the loop there would be, and this is a study that, of course, will never be done, would be to expose these infants to pertussis and see whether or not they develop the infection.
You're right. Now, we do know that in this particular situation, they were able to measure the antibody response to mothers and children, and it was a robust response.
Excellent. Speaking of children then, now let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Really, what I thought was quite an interesting study, very cleverly designed, taking a look at autism and coming to the determination that genetics and environmental factors are involved.
I agree with you. I thought this was a very interesting study on two aspects. One is the results of the study, because it addresses an important question. We know that the incidence of autism appears to be increasing, so that now affects about 1-2% of all children born in the United States. One of the questions is the incidence really increasing, or reporting it more often, and how much of this is due to genetic problems and how much of it is due to environmental issues? So this looked at a population of over 2 million Swedish children born from 1982 to 2006. Twins, either identical twins, which are called monozygotic, or fraternal twins, which are called dizygotic, siblings, and or half-brothers or half-sisters, to see what the recurrence risk was among all those different genetic perturbations. And what they discovered was the relative recurrence risk among identical twins was very high, 153 per 100,000 person years. Among fraternal twins, it was 8. For siblings, about 10. For half-brothers or half-sisters, about 3. And for cousins, about 2. Now, what that tells us is that the individual risk of autistic spectrum disorders does increase with increasing genetic relatedness. But when they looked at it, the heritability of autistic spectrum disorders were estimated to be approximately 50%. That is, 50% of the likelihood was due to genetic determinants, and the other 50% due to environmental factors.
So this, of course, is really, really interesting information. It goes nowhere with regard to telling us what environmental factors are important, of course.
No, it doesn't. And it's also hard to put into the perspective of a parent who says, listen, if I have a child that has autistic spectrum disorders, what's the likelihood that the next child will have it? Let me reframe it by saying that for individuals that have a full brother or sister with autistic spectrum disorder, the probability of a diagnosis of another sibling is about 13%. And if it's for monozygotic twins, it's about 59%. Fraternal twins, about 13%. For half brothers or sisters, 6-8%, and about 2.5% for cousins.
Interesting. No doubt we're going to be hearing plenty more about this particular issue. Finally, then, let's remain in the Journal of the American Medical Association and talk about another issue we've heard a lot about and that we're likely to hear even more about, a very concerning increase in the incidence of diabetes among American youth, let's call them, especially, I would say, the increasing problem with type 1 diabetes.
This is what caught me by surprise, because we've talked about type 2 diabetes and its relatedness to obesity. There's a trial that was started in 2001 called the SEARCH trial, and it was an attempt to look at a very large population, over 3 million youths, to ascertain what the prevalence was of diabetes then. And now we have that same population in which those determinations were made in 2009. What they determined was the prevalence of type 1 diabetes during that time period increased about 21%, and the incidence of type 2 diabetes increased by about 30%. With regard to type 1 diabetes, the highest prevalence is among the white youths. Now, the exact opposite happened with regard to type 2 diabetes. 30% increase in prevalence during that same time period. The highest prevalence was among American Indian youth, followed by Black youth and Hispanic youth, and the lowest prevalence was actually among white youth.
Of course, the one that's confounding really is the type 1, because we don't really understand what gives rise to that.
Absolutely. And we don't have an explanation for it.
Does it suggest that there ought to be screening programs employed to start taking a look at this among all pediatric patients in the United States and potentially even worldwide?
We probably don't need to screen for type 1 diabetes. That becomes pretty evident clinically. But you're right. Type 2 diabetes is oftentimes asymptomatic or silent. And I'm sure the prevalence would be much higher if we screened for individuals.
Definitely something we need to keep an eye on. On that note, then, I'll reveal that, of course, I'm going to do the autism study in the Journal of the American Medical Association this week on the blog.
Good pick.
Thank you. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.